Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds.
It's Freedom News Hour Possibilities. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today's Thursday, July 31st, 2014, last day of July. And some of the headlines we'll be talking about today, we're going to talk about the stimulus that's been going on for, about forever now, 6 years or so. And it hadn't really accomplished much, but are there signs that there may actually be increases in growth now that it's fading? We're also going to look at the possibility that citizen chats may actually be defeating the NSA and the FBI. That should be interesting. And a follow-up about the climate situation. Are the climate models actually failing? Look at that. But we're starting off with something we haven't really focused on yet, and that is the ongoing strife in the Middle East, particularly in the Gaza area, with Israel invading and the Hamas organization firing rockets and all kinds of havoc being run loose in the Bill. You and I were chatting by email about this, and you raised a couple of interesting points, including the fact that essentially this is a sort of a test case, if you will, on some of the very basic principles of what is considered to be a just or an unjust war. Phrases, which actually I find to be somewhat contradictory among, even within themselves. To me, there's no such thing as a just war, but why don't you elaborate on what you were talking about?
Yeah, well, we had discussed the situation in Iraq briefly, and I just thought it would be useful to consider the situation in Gaza, and I'm very strongly opposed to what Israel is doing. I think it's depraved in a sense. Not just the recent attacks, killing hundreds of civilians, thousands of people, including kids and women, but the whole approach and attitude toward Gaza as a what amounts to an independent nation, because it's essentially a military occupation, and the country is blocked by sea, blocked by land. They can't even get things through tunnels without Israel intervening. And it just isn't a civil society. It's a military occupation. And I have some sympathies for the Gazans, and I can kind of get away with that because my wife is Jewish and my three daughters are all bat mitzvah, and so I can't be accused of anti-Semitism or anything like that. But
well, sure you can.
I can. Yeah, but it's hard to make the case. But my sentiments are just generically in opposition to any kind of theocratic rule, which is the standard in the Middle East. So I'm just as opposed to the Jewishness of the Jewish state as I am to the Arabness or Islamicness of the Palestinian state or states. But what's going on now, and the reason it struck me was because one of the elements of the just war theory, and this is, you know, something that was developed centuries ago and has some merits and demerits, but the idea of proportionality. If somebody shoots a rocket, you don't drop a nuclear bomb on them. You know, if one person is killed, you don't kill 1,000 in retaliation. It just isn't ethical way to conduct a conflict or a disagreement. Both sides have their demerits, and both sides seem excited and anxious to fight whenever they can and create havoc whenever they can. And it's a sad situation all around. But the way that Israel has responded to what are essentially, they call them rocket attacks, but they're almost entirely rocket-propelled grenades and mortars. These are very small arms. They shot off 2,000 of them in the past year or whatever. 99.9% of them landed in the desert. The space between Gaza and any Israeli population is just desert, and that's where they land or they blew up or whatever it is. And up to the point where Israel invaded, not a single Israeli had been killed, and there hadn't been any reports of even injuries from these rockets. So it just strikes me as totally disproportionate in any kind of, you know, justice, sense of justice or proportionality.
one of the things that goes out the window, of course, in any kind of war-like situation is the truth, which we've talked about a number of times. And I think this is actually no exception here, because the propaganda coming out of both camps, I mean, three-quarters of it, you kind of roll your eyes and you say, okay, now we're supposed to believe this, too. Now we're supposed to believe this, too. And of course, they're all completely at odds with what the other camp is saying. I think I mentioned this last week, but I've long felt that the whole Middle East crisis, and particularly the situation with Israel and the Palestinians, smacks very much of the Hatfields and McCoys. It's a feud.
Run that by me again? Both,
I'm sorry?
Smacks of?
It smacks of the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Hatfields and McCoys, yeah.
And the reason I say that is both sides have claims dating back centuries about the atrocities the other side committed, and you know how they stole our land and we stole their land, but we didn't steal their land until they stole ours, and they've been attacking us, and well, they've been attacking us, and you know, on and on and on and on. Now, putting that into the context of a just war theory, well, first of all, like I said at the top of the cast, there is no such thing as a just war. Let's look at what war actually is. War is where you have two competing governments fighting each other, and they do so by killing each other's citizenry. What's just about that? There's nothing just about that. I don't care whether it's proportional or not. Killing the other people's citizenry because you have a beef with the government, there is no justice there. You can argue that it's necessary if you want to. You can argue that it's self-defense if you want to. But I don't buy it. I mean,
yeah,
that's kind of like me having a – that's like kind of being a McCoy or a Hatfield and shooting the McKenzies because they live down the street from the Hatfields. It's crazy. It's just it, and saying that that's a just war. I mean, no, it doesn't – whether or not proportionality is involved – and I agree there's something to be said about proportionality in some weird sense. But put that aside for a moment. All the proportionality argument really is a way of justifying war. That's the real purpose of it. They want to be able to fight the war. They don't want to look like really, really bad guys, so they come up with a theory of a just war. They still want to fight the war. They still want to go loot the other side. They still want to take stuff from the other side that doesn't belong to them, but they want to justify it. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not justified. It really is.
Well, it's justified if you're attacked and if people are killing your citizens and threatening an invasion or something like that. It's perfectly reasonable to respond to that. My problem is that the people in Gaza, the Palestinians, fired off 2,000 missiles. I'd be perfectly happy if Israel fired off the equivalent number of missiles, or twice as many, or even three times as many, at the people who were launching these rockets. That's fine. That's proportional. That's reasonable.
They aren't going to necessarily fire it at the people who fired the rockets. They're going to fire it at the people who live somewhere near the people who fired the rockets. And that's the same thing for the Palestinians. The Palestinians, like you say, their rockets aren't even getting through for the most part. But even the attempts are not aimed at the Israeli government. They're aimed at the Israeli citizenry. So whether or not they actually hit is beside the point. The point is he shouldn't be firing at the Israeli citizens in the first place, and the Israelis shouldn't be firing at the Palestinian citizens in the first place. Now, the whole question is self-defense. Sure. Do people have the right to defend themselves? Do countries have the right to defend themselves? Absolutely. Of course they do. But let's not pretend that having the right to do so makes it just. It just means you have the right to defend yourself. You have a right to live. You have the right to take extreme measures if you have to. But you don't do it as a matter of policy, as a matter of this is the way we're going to do our governing. You do it because it's a last gasp, desperate measure to stay alive.
Well, self-defense is always just.
It applies to individuals as much as government. It may pass judicial standards, but killing can't possibly be considered just under any circumstances that I can.
Well, particularly when no foreign enemy has killed any of your citizens. The number of Israelis killed was zero until the invasion started, and there was no justification for the invasion in the first place.
I
find it difficult to discard the assumption that Israel's objective is to never have peace and to basically drive all of the Arabs and all the Palestinians out of Gaza by barricading them in a jail. It's ironic. It's the closest thing to a concentration camp that exists anywhere in the world.
Other than Guantanamo, I agree with you.
Well, Guantanamo is theoretically a jail, but this is a concentration camp because it's a very concentrated
jail that behaves like a concentration camp, whereas theirs is a concentration camp that behaves like a jail.
But it's particularly when you look at the statistics, there's like 1.3 million people living in Gaza, and most of them are in old British encampments that were like ghettos set up for the poorest people in Gaza. But right now, 50% of the population of Gaza is under the age of 18. Almost 20% or 30% of the adults are females. So it's anytime you have any kind of concerted bombing and attacks of that sort, you're going to kill civilians, and probably somewhere between 40 and 60% of the people who were killed by Israel were civilians.
Mm-hmm.
According to everybody that's reporting on it.
Except for the Israelis.
Well, the Israelis classify anybody living in Gaza as a belligerent.
Yeah, they do. And by the way, my earlier reference to the Hatfields and McCoys, that was just an idle reference. Because I think one of the big, big lessons that comes out of the whole saga of the Hatfields and McCoys is that blood feuds in particular show the irrationality of killing in order to defend yourself. Ultimately, all killing of human beings, particularly for political purposes, inevitably leads to more killing. I can't think of a single instance in history, can you, where killing for political purposes led to fewer killings?
Well, one of the definitions which has kind of been abandoned of killing civilians for political purposes is terrorism.
Yeah.
And that's in a lot of the legislation that's been passed in the U.S. The basic definition of terrorism is that civilians are killed in order to obtain political goals.
Right.
And if that isn't what Israel is doing, I don't know what else to call it.
So you're calling them terrorists now. That's fun.
Oh. you get some bad emails now.
Yeah.
No, I say it fits the definition, and if the shoe fits.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, once again, I have to point out the obvious, and the obvious is killing leads to more killing. And that is something that should be so blatantly obvious to everyone, I shouldn't even have to go into it anymore, but I feel like I do have to, because I feel like people have forgotten what the basics of life was. So let me just touch on that for a moment. This is kind of like kindergarten 101. If you go over and beat up on somebody else, they're likely to either beat up on you or they're going to ask their big brother to beat up on you, and then you're going to call your big brother to beat up on them, and so on and so on and so on. Violence always begets more violence. And this is... This isn't just an examination of what happens in war. This is an examination of what happens in life. Coercion leads to coercion. Coercion specifically meaning force used against other human beings in order to achieve some sort of an end. Well, that's the history of government. It's the history of war. It's the history of struggles in the Middle East. It's the history of virtually every contentious type of situation that ended up with lives being taken in human history. And all these situations continue. The only times that I can ever point to where they stopped was where there was a complete genocide. In other words, they literally wiped out the other side. And that's
my only point, there is a difference between initiating coercion and retaliating against it or defending yourself against it. And that's a central concept in any kind of civil society. Now, maybe you can say neither one of these societies are very civil, but nevertheless, it just the initiation of force that was done by Israel in this particular case. Now, in the past, there have been wars where they were literally attacked before they responded and ended up winning wars. In fact, Gaza was for a long time, hundreds of years, part of Egypt, along with the rest of the Sinai. And after the last war between Israel and the various Arab states, Israel gave back the Sinai, which is basically a bunch of desert out in the middle of nowhere, but they kept Gaza. And they never offered any method or means for the people living in Gaza to either have a self-government or to have autonomy as an independent nation.
And yet, of course, if we keep going back, and this is why I refer to the whole thing about being in kindergarten, and I'm going to tell my big brother about you and so on and so forth. It's a metaphor, it's an illustration of what happens in real life, and Israel and the Middle East are a perfect example of it, because both sides can point to atrocities going back further. And maybe it's like 5 years, and then 10 years, and 15, 30, 40, 50, 100, 200, 500,000. And so the question ultimately gets begetted, which is, who started it? Sure, yeah. I agree that you shouldn't initiate coercion, but when the two sides can't even agree on who started it, you basically have a kindergarten situation, don't you? Well, he started. No, he started.
Well, if you accept the Bible as documentary evidence of what actually transpired, the Israelis left Israel and went to Egypt because Israel was having a drought and they couldn't grow food. And so the Canaanites managed to survive and they took over the area where the Jews had abandoned. And the Jews came in and killed men, women, children, beasts of every kind and sort that lived on the promised land. So it's even in terms of historic biblical, you know, millennia, Israel is the one that started the war. You know,
well,
God
yeah,
told them to go get them.
Every one of those instances you can bring up, I guarantee you, a defender of Judaism, of the Israeli state, is going to come up with one that surpasses it going back a little bit further. And that's my point. There is no way of finding out who started the atrocities. You have to kind of draw a line somewhere in history and say, okay, from this point on, no more atrocities, except by that time it's already been, the atrocities have been created.
Yeah.
So
well,
again,
I don't think
that the principle of initiation of force really is going to work in the Middle East, because no one will ever agree on who initiated the atrocities.
Well, perhaps. I mean, it is a blood feud. It's like the Hatfields and McCoys.
Hatfields
and
McCoys.
And it's, you know, Israelis, westernized white race. It's basically racist against the Arab nations. So it's that.
And the Israelis have claimed just the opposite, that it's racism against the Jewish nation.
And they will probably deny that...
Again, it's the pointing of the fingers. You know what I think is the best example of what happens when you point fingers? This is the way I like to settle an argument. When you point a finger, look what happens. Point your finger like you're you know, aiming a gun or something like that. And what do you see? You see your forefinger pointing toward the other side, probably your thumb's either pointing up or pointing toward them. And then you've got three other fingers. They're all pointing back at you. And that's what happens when you point fingers. You point fingers, and fingers, including your own, end up getting pointed back at you.
Well, but fingers don't kill people.
No, they don't, but they are the basis for the argument of who started.
I'll accept that.
All right, well, that's fair. I think, actually, we've gone a little bit further on the segment we're planning to go anyway, but... This is like one of those debates that could go on endlessly, because it has gone on.
True, true.
I think at some point you have to decide, do you want to live peacefully? And so far, I think the answer from both sides is no.
Well, my solution for the problem is give Gaza back to Egypt, give the West Bank back to Jordan, and let them decide how to deal with them. Let Israel be Israel. You know.
Well, it's an interesting proposal. I think we'll have to watch the headlines to see when it's being implemented, but I would say...
Not something John Kerry's going to propose. Well, you know, or a three-state solution. You know, three states, you have Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, and you let Gaza become an independent nation, you let the West Bank become an independent nation, and, you know, as long as they aren't committing, you know, attacks against Israel, then they govern themselves.
Yeah,
and they fail,
you know,
or they
play over their belief that that's going to be the case. Anyway, speaking of things that don't work out the way you're hoping they're going to, let's take a look at the stimulus. Because the stimulus...
It's a blood feud.
There's another blood feud, yeah. The stimulus that's been in place has actually been in two parts. One's been by the central bank, the other's been by the federal government. And I think you and I agree that it has been a dismal failure up to this point. Now, you dug up an article that suggested that a rather interesting event may be happening. Why don't you detail what that article is about?
Most recent number was that the U.S. economy has grown by 4% while the Fed cut the stimulus. That's 4% is annualized. I mean, this is numbers from the last month. It's an annualized rate for April to June. But what strikes me is peculiar about this story is that the stimulus is supposed to result in economic growth. Now, all during this past 2 years of stimulus, there's been no growth. When they start trimming the stimulus, then there's a growth. And the machinations they go through to try to argue that the stimulus is what resulted in or caused the growth is just totally ridiculous. So I find it amusing how the Keynesians view the stimulus. I mean, they're constantly looking for more and more stimulus because they claim that stimulus creates growth, and they've been demanding it for the past 6 years. And it hasn't. I mean, it hasn't even succeeded in eliminating the financial crisis of home and property values. That's still a total disaster. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that hold like 80 or 90% of all the home mortgages, has been bankrupt for the past 4 years, and it's just surviving on the Fed printing money and sending it off to Fannie and Freddie. And that's supposed to solve the problem? No, it hasn't solved the problem at all. Housing prices are exactly where they've been. And meanwhile, the Fed is easing off because they recognize with all the different factors. Unemployment's still far above what was considered the norm for the Fed was 5%, still far above that. The threat of inflation because they pumped all this money, literally hundreds of billions of dollars, and it may have actually broken $1 or $2 trillion. I don't recall the numbers. Has accomplished almost nothing beneficial.
Yeah, which is rather astonishing when you think about it. I'm sure you're not going to get any response from Keynesians because Keynesians basically abhor responding to factual information. What they're interested in is promoting the agenda, so why should they bother? You know, besides, they have power, so they don't have to justify it. But the figure that caught my attention was 4%. The reason I say that is that there was an article that appeared toward the beginning of the year in magazine was, I think it was at Barron's, one of the financial investment magazines. The cover said they were predicting a surprising 4% growth for the year. And the basis for their prediction, it came from basically a hedge fund management firm. The basis for their prediction was they figured there's going to be a banner year in real estate. Well, it turns out real estate hasn't exactly had a banner year, but they're reporting a 4% number anyway. So it raises a question in my mind. And the question is, how do they manufacture it?
Well, here's what they do. Here's what they do. Like the first quarter, January, February, March, U.S. economy, according to their tabulations, shrank by 2.1%. Now, again, this is annualized. It wasn't for that specific period. So when they look at the number for April, May, June, the second quarter, and they annualize that, it's a 4% growth. In other words, they don't put the 4% and the 2% together and say, well, you know, year to date, it's only 2% growth. They want to pump up that number, so they just look at April to June and then annualize it by multiplying by 4. So the growth in that quarter was actually 1.6%, I think.
And that really shows just the power of messing around with numbers. Because here we have I'm not even sure I believe the 1.6 figure, but here we have a 1.6%, which is probably closer to truth than anything, and they managed to manufacture that into 4% just by playing around with how they talk about the numbers. I mean, that's really quite amazing. It's quite a feat. It's quite disgusting, but it's amazing what they can pull off.
Yeah. No, I mean, they do that every time there's a report that comes out. What they won't do is add up both of the numbers and end up with an overall trend for the year to date, which is, I think, a 1.4% figure if you take 6 months to multiply by two. That means during the first 6 months, it was less than 0.8% growth, which is anemic. I mean, in the past, the Fed has said that they'd like to have unemployment below 5% and growth above 3.5%. They haven't had growth above 3.5% since 2007. So it's an abject failure. It's putting all kinds of distortions, not just into the housing market, but into the stock market as well. All of these different stimulus programs and regulations and so on, they're controlling the economy, and they're an absolute, total, abject failure at it.
And what's really remarkable about all this, we started off talking about the headline being stimulus fades as growth increases. And as it turns out, as the stimulus fade, growth isn't really increasing. It's all a big charade. It's not true.
Well, what isn't a charade is the net worth of U.S. households. Inflation-adjusted net worth, and again, you can argue with the inflation numbers, but...
Which I frequently do.
Yeah. A typical household had a net worth of $87,000. 10 years later, this is in 2003, 10 years later, it's $56,000, a 36% decline since 2003. Now, this is the, is the average Joe Blow homeowner... and how much they've got in the bank and savings or investments and so on and so forth. I don't know how you call this a recession. I mean, this is comparable to the depression of the 30s and the 40s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, the numbers are larger numbers, but that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. 94% of the population had less wealth over the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. The remaining 4% were in that 1% category had a 4% increase. But actually, if you look at the number, the net worth of wealthy households did not go up in this past 10 years as much as they had in the previous 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, everybody's hurting, and it's
except
all
for the bank.
A mess.
The banks and Fannie and Freddie, they're doing just fine, comparatively speaking.
Well, you know, I'm not sure about that.
Well, I'm not saying they're doing fine because they're actually being productive. I mean they're doing fine because they've been thoroughly bailed out over and over and over again. I mean, you get bailed out enough, and then, you know, hey, I'm in the money.
Well, here's why that is true. Again, it's another federal intervention. The Fed told the banks, okay, we will pay you 5% to improve your equity shares for all of the money that you give us. And we're going to pay you 5% interest on any dollars that you turn over to the Fed as reserves. So the banks are making 5% just sitting around and smoking their pipes. And there's nobody else in the economy that's making 5%. Even the best businesses are barely squeaking by on 2 or 3% growth, and the average Joe Blow is squeaking by on 30% negative growth over the past 10 years. So it's, again, no matter what aspect you take of this Fed intervention or the regulations or the controls or all these different things, everything that government does damages the general population and the economy.
Oh, I agree, but it's even worse than that. What we have here is a failure of a philosophy to work. The philosophy was and is, if you bail out the banks, you save the economy. And they bailed out the banks. They bailed them out so thoroughly that the banks can't help but show profits. Even with all the ways of being fined, they're still showing profits because of this 5-to-1, you know, ratio that you're talking about in terms of making money for free.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, despite that fact, the economy is in tatters. Like you say, you know, the average household's lost, you know, 36% of its value over the last 10 years. Most corporations are struggling. You know, where's the economic recovery? Well, there isn't any. So essentially, the powers that be, the financial powers that be, dating back to Hank Paulson and Timothy Geithner and the Follett and the Obama administration and Ben Bernanke and all that stuff, All of them were promising us, this is how you save the economy, and it didn't. It didn't.
Nope. And then the illusion of the stock market breaking new records is also just a fable.
No, you've talked about that one quite a bit, too.
Yeah, we have. There's what Bloomberg calls bubble paranoia among the S&P 500. 2 years of uninterrupted gains in U.S. stock valuation, primarily because of borrowing, but 3 in 5 people who are market analysts say that the stock market is on the verge of a bubble or already in one. 37% said the equity market is close to unsustainable levels, while 14% say we're already in a huge bubble.
So, well, while you reach for the bottle of cyanide, we're going to take a little break, and then after the break, we'll talk about a little good news. Actually, believe it or not, there's some good news that we have discovered a way in which the NSA cannot track us, and they even admit it. It's pretty cool.
So we'll
be back after a few minutes. This is the Freedom News Hour, Possibilities here on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome, Bill, back here on the Freedom News Hour on this Thursday evening, last Thursday of July, 2014. And as I hinted before the break, the NSA has they got some fire in their faces. They found a way that they can't track us, which is almost astonishing these days. But, Bill, you dug this one up from the Washington Post. What's this revelation?
There's two different aspects to it, but this particular story was about the fact that the competition for secure online services has just totally blossomed since the Snowden revelations. People don't want the government snooping on them, and so they're going to online chats, messaging services, and other communications that are not required by the law, unlike cell phones and things, to provide a means for the NSA to track them. So even though the NSA issues a warrant for, let's say, Skype, you know, as an example, Skype doesn't have to comply because there's no provision in the law that covers those kinds of online chat services. Chat rooms can be set up by anybody with a server anytime they want, and so they're being frustrated. They call it going dark because they don't have the capability and they're not required by law to facilitate the NSA snooping. And so that's good news, and directly as a consequence of Snowden, forget what the Congress is going to do about the NSA. But there was another aspect of this that also was encouraging, and that was a few months back. There was a Snowden revelation, and the NSA came out and said, well, yeah, that's maybe, you know, a little bit of a distortion, because even though we're collecting a trillion email messages and metadata from all these different sources, we only have an opportunity to look at maybe 1% of them. So the simple fact that people are just talking too much and writing too much has totally baffled the NSA, and so they're blaming that fact that Americans are talking too much for the reason why they've been totally unsuccessful at stopping terrorism with their bulk collection program.
You realize there's sort of an ironic twist going on here, because particularly where regulation is concerned, the government has been burying us in paper that has to be processed in order to satisfy the regulations. They've been doing that for decades. And now here's the citizenry burying the NSA in conversations that they have to sort through in order to find terror. There's like a little bit of a justice in there, don't you think? Yeah, it's like fair, you know. Well, I can't say it's fair. Fair is probably the wrong word. It's appropriate. Let's put it that way.
Appropriate. There you go. I'm going to go along with that.
Well, that's pretty cool.
And,
you know,
there are a fair number of people using encryption systems that the NSA has admitted they can't break. One of them is called Tor, T-O-R. And Tor is basically a communication system that breaks up messages into like 20 or 30 different servers that handle each little packet of each communication, and then only assemble them when each of these packets, you know, are acquired by the the person to receive the message. And so along the way, there's just no way that the NSA can monitor those kind of communications. So it's always good to see technology beating out government controls.
It is, although I have to admit there is a little bit of a quiver of suspicion for me in that story, because I do know that historically, any time the NSA opens their mouth, we know that they're lying.
Right.
So in this case, what they're saying is we can't break Tor. So the first question that goes through my mind is, oh, so when did they break it?
I don't think they have.
I'm not saying that it's going to be easy to do. I'm not saying that it's not a good technology. It's just the first thought that came to my mind, because when a liar lies, it'll stop lying, you know?
Well, they never did admit. And there was an interesting, I think it was 60 Minutes or somebody, doing a report on Stuxnet. And Stuxnet was a kind of a worm program that was installed on Iranian computers in order to destroy their refinement of uranium. And it worked to one degree or another. We're not sure how well it worked. But here's the interesting thing. As soon as they sent it to Iran, Iran now has the Stuxnet virus. And you can actually go on the web now, because it's spread into Turkey. It's spread into all kinds of other countries. You can go online and get, for a free download, the Stuxnet source code. And so, yeah, seriously. And so all of the intelligence agencies are just totally flustered and irritated that people can actually get the code that they wrote to infiltrate Iran and can use it to infiltrate all kinds of industrial operations. The program is based on Siemens controllers, which are everywhere in the world. Including all over the United States. So even power stations and communication grids and even nuclear power plants have all these controllers in them, and they're scared to death that somebody's going to take their program code that they wanted to use on Iran and use it to make a real mess of the U.S. economy.
I don't know if you're a Harry Potter fan at all, but there's a segment of the Harry Potter story that resonates where this is concerned, because in the last book, they have this big battle of good and evil going on, and one of the students who leans toward the evil side ends up setting off a curse called Fiend Fire or Cursed Fire, and it's essentially a curse where they start the fireball and it keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. And unfortunately, he doesn't know what the counter curse is, so he can't stop it. that's basically what you just described. You basically described a cursed fire that got put out there into the wilderness by the NSA, and they can't put it out.
That's true. I mean, that's what it amounts to. And you know, there's a variety of other things that are going on in the background that rarely get me the attention. But a large proportion of the NSA contractors who are, you know, doing all of their cybersecurity stuff and cyber attack stuff and cyber warfare stuff are criminals that they flipped into becoming programmers for the NSA. So they have brought in all of these hackers, and God only knows. I mean, Snowden was bad enough, but God only knows how much these hackers have been able to infiltrate the systems they're working for in order to either make money or provide information to, you know, foreign governments or businesses or whatever it is. So it's lots of interesting little developments that are going on, which has, in fact, resulted in the Congress actually going back to some serious legislation to restrict the NSA. And if you recall, there was a bill, I think it went in with Rand Paul's support and Justin Amash, called the U.S. Freedom Act. Well, it was gutted by the House.
Right.
It went to the Senate, and the leadership in the Senate, there are so many Democrats, progressives, that are totally peeved about this kind of surveillance, that the legislation has been rewritten back into the original form. Mm. And so the prospect is that it may not be, you know, the perfect solution, But they're putting all kinds of restrictions into the law that's being considered.
So the only thing wrong with that approach is that what the law should say is that the NSA is closed, but even now it's kind of hard to enforce.
Well, it isn't just in the U.S. either. In Britain, they passed laws since the Snowden revelations that restrict data retention. Basically, the parliament in Britain has said, we're just going to drop the law that requires telephone providers to retain data. And they passed the law, and the government said, wait a second, if they don't retain the data, how are we going to get it? It's an interesting situation in Britain, because there's been as many revelations about the GCHQ, which is British intelligence, mm-hmm. as there have been about the NSA. And
I have to admit,
that one
that you just mentioned, that one actually has a chance to have legs, because it doesn't require the government to enforce it in order for it to have teeth. And that's a good thing.
Run that by me again?
Well, the law basically says to the telecoms, you don't have to hold the data anymore. The government doesn't have to enforce that. The telecoms can just choose, oh, good, we don't hold the data anymore, so we're not going to hold it anymore.
Right.
It requires the government intervention.
Right, right.
And that's
really
no way for the NSA and the and all the equivalents of the other countries to step in and say, whoa, we got to amend this thing so it doesn't have any teeth anymore. Well, it has all the teeth that it needs because the government doesn't do any actual enforcement.
Right.
The enforcement happens through private enterprises and private entities taking action on their own. That's the ultimate enforcement.
Yeah, I think we discussed this several months back, and that is that the data retention laws in the United States started out where there was a good business practices law that said that cell phone companies and telephone companies and so on had to retain their records for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSA came in and they said, well, 3 months is not good enough because we want to be able to go back for, at least a year, maybe a year and a half. So without Congress approving it, they just changed it. The Federal Communication Commission changed the law to require 18 months of retention. And with the UK totally eliminating that requirement, that's another portion of the legislation that's being considered by the U.S. Senate now, which mm-hmm. is to just eliminate the data retention requirements.
Now, of course, there is the downside. You hinted at it there, which is since they're not retaining data for consumers' benefit, now consumers have a lot less ability to challenge an incorrectly billed bill or something along that line because the data isn't being kept anymore. So there is that side of it, and that's a side that they have to at least address to some extent, I would think. You got to require they keep the data for a certain period of time. But what would be an even better amendment to the law is, yes, they have to keep it for a certain period of time, but the intelligence services can't have it.
Yeah, for business purposes, every business, every cell phone and telephone company was keeping records of the transactions, the metadata, for 3 months, and that was in their contract that the consumer could dispute a billing up to 3 months after the call, and that's why they retained the data for 3 months. And if there was a legal dispute about the proper billing pricing or whatever it was, then they could present that evidence in court in their own defense or as part of the lawsuit against the telecom company. So they're going to do that anyway. The question is whether the government is going to require them to do that. They would do that for a reasonable period of time, and it was 3 months. Was the average. It wasn't consistent. It was some were 2 months, some were 4 months, and so on. But without any government requirements or dictates, just on the basis of normal good business practice to defend yourself against lawsuits, you keep records for a reasonable period of time, and you put it in the contract how long the customer has to dispute the billing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you don't need any laws.
You need one. You need a law that says that the intelligence services can't happen.
Well, that... Yeah.
I'm not saying it's going to be an effective law, but you can at least give them the opportunity to turn down the NSA when the NSA comes knocking and says, you got to give us the data. You can't tell anyone that we asked for it. And if you do tell anyone that we asked for it, we'll send you to jail.
Well, I mean, that can be defeated just by enforcing the Fourth Amendment. You know, you don't have to write a law saying the NSA can't do this, can't do that, can't do this, can't do that, can't.
But there are no enforcement provisions for the Fourth Amendment. There are no enforcement provisions for the U.S. Constitution. I mean, I'm not saying I wouldn't like to have them, but there aren't any. There are no enforcement provisions.
Well, only courtesy to the Supreme Court when it decides in favor of citizens and individual rights, but...
Yeah, you don't want to rely on that. I can tell you that. Just trust me. Historically, they're pretty honest. You don't want to go there.
I'll take your word for it.
Speaking of things you don't want to go to, you don't want to go to the next meeting of the AGW Haters Club, because the anthropogenic global warming people who are saying that this has been an ongoing problem, they now have an ongoing problem. But it's not the one they had in mind. We talked about this last week, and I remember we even hypothesized we're going to probably start seeing reports that the climate models are now failing because they aren't matching up to the actual temperature readings. And indeed, that's what you found. You found an article that shows exactly that.
Yeah. This has been fairly noteworthy exception to the climate hysteria that comes from one side. But it was 10 years ago that the NSA built a satellite, sent it up, and started collecting actual data on global warming. And they didn't release any of the data until they got an accumulated record for 10 years. And they also, in that same interim period of time, they started cleaning up the various weather stations on the ground. And they ended up with like 114 that weren't affected by urban change or urban warming or bad site locations, so on. They cleaned it all up. And as a consequence, their data for the past 10 years from both the ground and the satellite is that there's been zero warming. In fact, there was actually cooling over the past 10 years. So it's something that's distressed a lot of the so-called environmentalists. But even some of the original hysterics, and one of them is a guy by the name of Ross McKittrick, who's been a big booster for the global warming scares. He says, what I can say from the standpoint of applying the scientific method response feature of models is that the average model result is inconsistent with the observed data. I mean, this is something that is astounding when it comes from people who were fairly notorious for warning us about global warming, which is not to say that there hasn't been global warming over the past 100 years. So there's no evidence that it correlates with CO2 concentration. There's no evidence that it correlates with consumption of fossil fuels or anything like that. And so they started turning away from the global warming issue and talking about sea level rise until the actual data came out from the government scientific analysis that the sea level rise has been the same in the past 10 years as it's been for the past 8,000 years. I mean, when you end an ice age, the result is that the water in the oceans, rises. And it's been rising at like 0.8 centimeters or something like that for the past 8,000 years.
Well, the article you cited, this, by the way, comes from dailycaller.com. That's where Bill dug this up. But they have some other quotes by this guy, McKittrick, who, as you pointed out, has been long a supporter of the whole AGW movement. And he makes some other astounding commentary that's quoted in the article. Let me just read a couple of them. The first one that caught my attention is... it says, but McKittrick says that observations show all the warming occurred in a single step change in the late 1970s, coinciding with a known event called the Pacific Climate Shift, and they identify no significant trend before or afterwards. So all, this is, I can't remember the last time I even heard anything like this. I mean, maybe you have, but the way it's always been presented to me is that there's this slow, steady growth in the average temperature across the board, across the planet. Here is somebody who's actually saying, somebody who is a proponent of the whole HEW theory, who is saying, well, no, actually what happened is the entire increase happened during one short period of time in the 1970s in an event known as the Pacific Climate Shift, where basically the ocean waters went from being cold to warm.
Yeah, well the, people aren't familiar with this.
That's an interesting little piece of news right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, people aren't too familiar with whatever the terminology was that they used. But most people know about El Niño. And El Niño is a change in the ocean currents that happens every, 15 or 20 years. And it happened to hit on this 1970 period. And that's one of the natural changes that automatically occurs systematically and periodically over many decades. Now, the other interesting thing about this is people are pretty well familiar with the facts for the past 10 years because of NSA and the satellite data. But what they're referring to here is data from 1958 to 2012. That's 55 years of data, which doesn't correlate with any of the models that they've set up that are supposed to forecast what the weather's going to be like in the future. Another thing that's happened, it's again one of those peripheral issues like global warming is causing this or that. The claim has been made over the past 5 years that because of global warming, Antarctica is losing ice.
Right. That's been the claim. That's been the
and
claim.
It turns out that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
The change over the past, what is the period here? Since the turn of the century, so the past 14 years. The Antarctic ice cover has increased by 1.3 million square miles. Now, there was a challenge to this from the hysterics saying, well, the numbers were wrong because of this and that. So even with their correction, which was about a 1% correction, the change in the Antarctic ice cover is enormous increase, not a decrease.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually 2 million square miles since 2002. So this correction was something like 200,000 square miles, and totally insignificant in comparison with the amount of increase that was actually measured.
Yeah, and that's definitely good information. I just can't get over the fact that this guy McKittrick has basically done an about-face, because, first of all, he's known about the specific climate shift for years now. I'm sure he has. I haven't known about it. I suspect you haven't known about it. I know most of the public has never heard of it, but apparently he's known about it, and it didn't bother him all this time. What changed his mind, and this is what he follows that quote that I identified, he follows it with this comment. In my opinion, the simplest and most likely interpretation of these results is that climate models on average failed to replicate whatever process yielded the step change in the late 1970s, and they significantly overstate the overall atmospheric response to rising CO2 levels. In other words, he doesn't like the fact that the temperatures came out to be considerably different from what the models suggested they should be. So now he's getting a conscience and saying, well, you know what? We really should have been paying attention all along to the specific climate shift, but we just kind of shifted it over because, well, it didn't really fit the model. And now we're finding out maybe we should have been paying attention to it all along. That's a major change. That's a major change from a major player.
Yeah, and there's it's interesting that the more facts we get, and we have to bear in mind all along here that the global weather was being estimated from literally thousands of thermometers spread around the globe, all at airports.
Yes. Not all airports, but there were a lot of weather stations. Right.
Almost all of them were at airports. And there were a few, urban temperature gauges. But the most accurate data hasn't been available since 1979, which is when they launched the first weather satellites that actually measured the temperature globally without any dependence upon, you know, what the different characteristics were of where the thermometers were located. And people are well aware that when they built these models, they built them with the bad data. And when you look at the models that the IPCC published year after year after year, none of them, and then they had a range like 55 different models, all that fell in this scope of range. The actual temperature since 1979, when they made the first predictions back in that period, were all off, either by 10% or 110% over the course of those, you know, those 30. Now, 30 years is a standard number of years that defines what climate is. Climate is a 30-year average.
Well, at least that's what the academics tell us.
Yeah, and so we've just had one 30-year period of data, and on that basis, they've made all these predictions with all kinds of assumptions that were totally speculative and unsupported by any kind of scientific evidence or any actual measurements.
And unfortunately, we can't provide any more evidence because we've run out of time.
No.
As usual, we always do this.
No.
Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Sure.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Possibilities. Goodbye, everybody.